the promise of mindfulness, I think, is that really everything that we experience, however painful or challenging it may be, can be transformed when it's met with kindness and with acceptance. So what we might have experienced as suffering, as alien, or as an unwanted experience can actually become a gateway to our freedom when we open fully to our experience. It's not, though, as you may know, many of you, it's not an easy path. We often say mindfulness is simple but not easy. You know, simple, we could say, well, just be here now. As Ram Dass said about 40 years ago, be here now. But being here now isn't so easy. It's not so easy because the mind often has a mind of its own, doesn't it? You might have noticed that during the meditation. So we really do need to train our minds. This is a path of training. It's a path of practice. And the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, taught a systematic path of training, which he called the Noble Eightfold Path, eight elements of this path, this training. And mindfulness is a key element of the path. It's really, he's talked about it as a direct path to freedom from suffering. So we can go all the way from simple awareness of our experience in this moment, the body, the feelings, the mind states, the emotions, all the way from this to full enlightenment. Just by bringing awareness to our experience in this moment just as it is. So without resistance, without judgment, without clinging. So I want to talk tonight about an aspect of this path to the end of suffering, and that is how we work with habitual behaviors, with habits, particularly the less healthy or more harmful ones or the less skillful ones. This probably only applies to about three of you, I know. And how we can transform these habits through mindfulness and lead a happier and a fuller and a freer life. What I'm going to share tonight is the thought that much of our suffering comes from behaviors that are habitual, that are outside of the frame of our everyday reference, that are kind of automatic in nature, that we're not really aware of. Just share an example. I was meeting with somebody some time back for some mindfulness counseling, and there was somebody who had some weight issues and wanted to live and eat more healthily. And I asked the person to kind of talk about what happened when they ate in a way that was unhealthy. I said, well, I have this kind of feeling, maybe feeling anxious or worried or nervous, and then the next thing I know, I'm in the kitchen and I've eaten a pint of ice cream. You know, it's kind of like in between. It's all, something happened, and there's not awareness of that whole in-between part. I mean, not every habit is exactly like that, but many of them are. That it's like, I think of it as like a train in a switching yard. You know, once the signal gets, you know, okay, this one goes down that particular track. So our habits are like that, where once we, and I'll talk in more detail about this, but once they get activated, kind of they bypass our conscious awareness. And that's why they can be so tricky and so challenging. So I'll talk about how mindfulness is a crucial way of changing even the most entrenched and painful and difficult habits. And I'll share some practices and meditations that you may find helpful in, if you feel inclined to explore habits or patterns in your life that are not so helpful, not so healthy, perhaps not so skillful. There are three, I think, main takeaway points from tonight's talk. Just kind of giving signaling in advance. One is that when harmful or unhealthy habits form, they can cause us a lot of suffering. Perhaps, probably most of us know this. And they can be hard to change. And I want to talk about why that's the case, why this is the case. So harmful, unhealthy habits, kind of almost goes without saying, they cause a lot of suffering and they can be hard to change. The second point is that mindfulness is a key to changing habits, because habits are characterized by automatic, unconscious patterns of thought and behavior. And so to change them, we need to bring them into the light of awareness. So it's like mindfulness is, you know, you might say it's a no-brainer. You know, that here you have lack of awareness, and here you have a practice of awareness. So they go together, you know, in an incredible way. And yet, there's been a lot of writing in recent years, a lot of research, a lot of books written on habits. Some of you may be familiar with Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit, which was a bestseller. Wonderful book, wonderful understanding and kind of explication of the research on habits and how we understand them. But the key missing piece is the mindfulness piece. Mindfulness is a way of transforming unhealthy patterns in our lives. And that's kind of why I'm interested, and I'm writing a book on habits and bringing mindfulness to unskillful, unhelpful habit patterns. So that's the second thing, too, that mindfulness is a key to changing habits. And the third main kind of point or takeaway is that there are three elements of mindfulness that are really key to changing unhealthy or unwanted habits. And these three elements are intention, attention, and attitude. So at the end of the talk, we'll have a quiz on that. Intention, attention, and attitude. And I'll talk about those, and I'll focus this evening mainly on the first. So this is a three-part talk, and this will mainly focus on intention, though I'll talk a little bit about the other two as well. Where the other two talks will happen, I don't know. So just kind of like, this is the beginning, I think. My guess is that all of us have, maybe some of us may have bypassed or gone beyond habits, but I think, or unhealthy habits at least, but I think all of us have or have had habits, patterns of thought or behavior that have become established and that we'd like to change. So unhealthy, unwanted patterns of thought and behavior that we'd like to change, but that we find difficult to change. Just a quick check. Does anyone have a habit that they feel like, oh, I keep doing this, but I'd like to change it, but have difficulty? There's quite a few people. Yeah, and that was my guess. Certainly I have mine. I'll maybe talk about some of mine. Maybe you know them, honey. So, for example, have you found yourself doing something and knowing at the time or soon after that your actions don't reflect the best of who you are? I'll just give a quick example of, like, I found some months ago, I was actually teaching a course on habits and mindfulness, and I found I was driving in this really kind of impatient way. You know, I was this driver who was, like, in competition with all of these other drivers, and kind of like I was on my way somewhere. I thought, wow. And I'd come home sometimes, I'd say, who was that guy who was driving? You know, it was kind of like, it was a pattern that had been set up. But fortunately, with mindfulness and the timing was good, I was kind of, oh, let me bring awareness to my intentions. And there was a realization that my intentions were not particularly skillful. You know, I need to get somewhere and I need to be there on time, you know. And my attention wasn't so good. You know, I was in the future much more than in the present. Got to get there. My attitudes weren't very kind to myself. I wasn't very accepting. But what was helpful was just to be able to bring this kind of exploration of like, oh, what's going on here? And I did that. And within a very short period, and ever since, you know, not that there aren't kind of lapses occasionally, but that using mindfulness, I was able to bring awareness to what was my deepest intention, you know, what was getting in the way of that, what was, you know, could I pay more attention, what was my attitude, you know, what were my attitudes, and cultivating more skillful, more wholesome attitudes in that particular activity of driving, which we do so much of the time. I mean, we spend a lot of time in our cars, at least many of us do. So we maybe do something with, like, why am I doing this? Maybe for some it might be, you know, you're eating too much or too often, not from hunger or need, but in response to some bodily feeling. You know, maybe you're feeling anxious or you're feeling nervous or you're feeling lonely, and your default habit might be to, you know, go for a cookie or, you know, a piece of cake or some ice cream. Others maybe spend long periods of time on the internet or social media. Anybody do that? You know, kind of like been in the situation where you come to a traffic light and you stop, and then the first thing you do is check your email. You know, I don't suppose anyone here ever does that. I did it once. You know, for some it might be smoking cigarettes, knowing that this is, you know, the serious health cost, but seemingly unable to kick the habit. Or maybe it's more patterns of thought or judgment, you know, of thinking negative or judgmental thoughts about yourself or about others, but really finding it really difficult not to. You know, maybe harsh judgments. Maybe it's, you know, being impatient or being angry with yourself or with other people. So there's a whole range of habits that we can get caught up in. You know, some of them are habits of wanting, you know, like we're wanting something. Some of them are habits of distraction, you know, like we're checking out. There's something not, doesn't feel good about the present moment, so, you know, we go to TV or we go to the internet, social media, whatever. Some of them are habits of resistance, like pushing away experience, judgment, impatience, frustration, anger. Some of them are habits of doing, you know, being on the way somewhere, you know, of constantly kind of moving into the future. So what I want to talk about this evening, next, is why are habits so hard to change? And why is mindfulness such a key method of bringing about change in our habits? I just want to talk a little bit about some of the neuroscience, you know, the understanding of our brains. That's come out mainly in the last 15 or 20 years or so. And there's a growing understanding of habits, how they're formed, how they operate, and why they can be so hard to change. These new understandings of habits are part of really of a wave of research on the brain and how it changes. Many of you are probably familiar with the term neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity. In simple English, all it means is that the brain changes throughout our lives, depending on what we do and depending on how we use our attention. So you might have heard of the research on London taxi drivers, how their brains get become thicker in areas related to visual, spatial memory, because they have to, or at least they had to, I don't know how it works with GPS now, but they had to remember how to get around 30,000 streets, and some of which were built 2,000 years ago, and, you know, they called it the knowledge, you know, how to get around, you know. So they're actually changing their brains through that 3 years of study. They found that the brains of violinists and pianists get thicker in areas associated with fine motor functions. The brain is amazing. They found that in blind people, that visual area of the brain, which isn't being used for sight, obviously, can be taken over for hearing. And likewise, for deaf people, the auditory area of the brain can get taken over for functions connected with vision. So, I mean, it's amazing changing brain that we have. They've also found that the brains of meditators, this is kind of inspiring, I think, they grew thicker in areas associated with self-awareness, compassion, and introspection, as well as learning and memory. So they got thicker, which is a good thing. And they thinned in areas associated with stress and anxiety. And this was after only 8 weeks of training. So 8 weeks of training changed the brains with an average of 27 minutes a day of meditation, brought about actual changes in the brain, not just the functioning, but in the structure of the brain. It thickened in these positive areas, thinned in these more negative areas of stress and anxiety. So all of this research is coming to very similar conclusions to those that were reached by the Buddha 2,500 years ago. Essentially, that we can train our minds, that how we use our attention can have a profound impact on our well-being and on our happiness. So what we pay attention to and how we pay attention can have a profound impact on well-being, on happiness, on peace, on freedom. Conclusions, you know, the neuroscientists aren't going as far as to say, you know, you can be enlightened and completely free from suffering, etc. They're more concerned with kind of more everyday well-being, but very, very similar conclusions. The Buddha said, what you frequently think about and ponder on, this becomes the inclination of your mind. What you frequently think about and ponder on, this becomes the inclination of your mind. So if you think a lot of angry thoughts, you know, and that's what you're fueling, angry thought, oh, they're always doing this to me, or angry with yourself, or angry with the world, that really becomes your mind's default mode. Because that's what we're fueling. That's where we're putting our attention. Conversely, if you think kind and loving thoughts, compassionate thoughts, this will become more the default mode of the mind. So coming back to habits, what is the scientific research, the neuroscience research on habits telling us? This is a very interesting thing. It's that almost half of the things that we do because we've done them before under very similar circumstances. 50% of what we do is really habitual. Actually, it's a little less, 45% of everyday behaviors that studies have found tend to be repeated in the same physical location every day. So this kind of, we think of ourselves as kind of making conscious decisions. I'm doing this because I want to do this, and this is my intention, this is my plan, this is my goal. And yet, once a habit forms, it actually gets shunted off to a different place. It's no longer really connected with intentions and plans and goals. The next thing really is that habits aren't a mistake. You know, some of them may appear to be, you know, they don't work for our benefits, as a number of things that go on in our brains don't always work to our benefits. But habits played a really important part in our evolution. What they did essentially is they allowed us to have smaller heads and more efficient brains, so that childbirth was easier, relatively, and fewer children and mothers died in childbirth. You know, imagine if we had to think about everything we do, we'd have much bigger brains and it would be much more challenging to even be born alive. Charles Duhigg, in his book on habits, he says, an efficient brain also allows us to stop thinking constantly about basic behaviors, such as walking and choosing what to eat. So we can devote mental energy to, as he put it, inventing spears, irrigation systems, and eventually airplanes and video games. So we've got more kind of mental real estate to do this other work, because we're not having to kind of everything we do consciously kind of bring it into the realm of thinking and cogitation and intention. Another really important thing about habits is they simplify our lives. Think how much more complex and stressful our lives would be if all our activities had to be the subject of decision making and thinking. You know, shall I get up? Shall I brush my teeth? What route will I take to work today? You know, I mean, sometimes those are good questions to ask, but we don't want to be doing them all of the time. You know, it's helpful to have kind of like, it's programmed. Okay, I get in my car, I put my seatbelt on. If I'm going to work, if it's that time of day, then I take this particular route. I've had the experience, probably you have as well, of where we've gone, you know, we've been going to a particular place and we find, oh, I've actually thought I was going to the other place. You know, mostly it's kind of hasn't been too much of a problem, but for me. But that's when these habits kind of take hold, and we're not bringing awareness to, okay, intentionally, this is where I'm going now, and focusing, bringing awareness. We're kind of the habits taking hold. So they're very helpful to us. They simplify our lives, but they can also get us into trouble. When we do something that at the time may be pleasant or that may help us deal with a difficult situation, we might do something like we might eat to calm ourselves, soothe ourselves, because we're feeling anxious or we're nervous or feeling lonely. And it can have that effect of, okay, for a while we feel, oh, or we have a glass of wine, okay, I feel calmer, I feel more at ease. But over time, when we keep doing that, whenever that trigger is there, whenever that cue is there, then that's how unhealthy, unwelcome, unwanted habits take hold. Here's how they form. So we do something to meet a need or to have a pleasant experience or avoid an unpleasant one. And once the action is repeated a number of times, patterns get formed in our memory, in our procedural memory, that link our actions to a particular context, a particular feeling, a particular place, a particular person, a time of day, a smell, a sight. And when that cue, that trigger, kind of is lit up, as it were, we act out, we do the habitual thing, or we think in the habitual way. The great psychologist Donald Hebb, over 50 years ago, had the expression, neurons that fire together, wire together. The more we kind of, more our mind goes down a particular path, you know, firing the synapses, you know, the more we do that, the more we reach for the cookie or the piece of cake, the more we do that, the more our brains are primed. They get wired to do that. So what the brain does is it chunks together behaviors, and when the trigger or cue is activated, we carry out the actions without deliberating or without reflecting. And once a habit is acquired, it becomes automatic. It's no longer linked to our intentions or our original goal. So what happens is habits are assigned to a different system of the brain, of brain functioning, from intentional actions, which are subject to reflection and decision-making. So we got these two parts of the brain. They're not physically parts of the brain, but two brain systems. Some of you may have read the Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, a great book. Daniel Kahneman is a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for Economics a couple of years ago. He's done this amazing research over a number of decades. But what he says that's relevant here to habits is essentially that habits fall into what he calls two generic modes of cognitive functioning, two brain systems. The first is an intuitive mode, which he calls system one, in which judgments and decisions are made automatically and rapidly. And then a system two, which is a controlled mode, which is deliberate and slower. So I'll give you an example. Imagine that you're walking through a wood, walking down a path through the woods. And you see something curled up ahead of you on the path. Now, what's going to happen is that system one will react automatically to the potential danger. You know, the amygdala, which kind of is the alarm bell of the brain, will signal danger. And, you know, all of the chemical responses of the, you know, blood going to the muscles to be able to fight or to flee or to freeze get activated. The system one kicks in. But what happens if we don't run away, you know, if we don't get panicked and run away, which, depending on the situation, might be a good thing to do or it might not be a good thing to do. If we can take a little bit longer, then system two kicks in, which is slower, and it assesses, it looks at things more closely. And maybe it verifies that, oh, it's not the color of a snake, or it's not the shape, or it's very still. And in fact, we see that it's a branch, and it's safe to proceed. So this is how system one goes into action. And system two, if we can give it a chance, kind of helps us see, oh, okay, no danger here. Okay, we're safe. Sometimes it's really, you know, system one can be enormously helpful. If something is coming at us at great speed, we'll automatically kind of go into that fight or flight mode. But we can also get caught up in system one where it's not so helpful. You know, we can get caught up in stress and anxiety and other kind of more challenging mental states when it's not useful for us. You know, when rather than running away from a bear, we're thinking about, oh, I've got that report to do, and we keep kind of activating all this stress response in the brain. So habits come within the immediate, automatically responding functioning of the brain. And many habits are not a problem. For example, you know, brushing our teeth or driving a particular way to work. But we can also develop habits that don't serve our interests or our deeper intentions. Probably all of us have some things that we do that we'd prefer we didn't do, but find it difficult to change. We pay a high price for unhealthy and unwanted habits, but the more we understand them, the more we can see that they're patterns that we can change, and we can find freedom from these unhealthy or unskillful patterns. Just a word about how the social costs of unhealthy habits. Tobacco use is responsible for 440,000 deaths, premature deaths, annually. That's 18% of all deaths in the US. Alcohol, illicit drugs, illegal drugs, and obesity make up an additional 21% of preventable US deaths. The costs, economic costs, are around $550 billion. That was 10 years ago. So huge social costs of unhealthy, harmful habits. One that's become much more serious in recent years is distracted driving. The numbers in 2011, 3,300 people died and 387,000 were injured as a result of accidents arising from distracted driving. So over 3,000 deaths, almost 400,000 injuries from, you know, checking text messages or sending messages or checking the internet or whatever. And in our individual lives, unhealthy or unwanted habits can cause intense physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual suffering. And also, when we try to change unhealthy habits, we can sometimes feel guilty or disappointed. And this can help perpetuate these behaviors. So all of this is to say, it's hard to change established habits. And what happens when we have an intention to change our habits, but the habit is strong? What happens? Has anyone here had a New Year's resolution that you haven't been able to carry out? Probably all of us, you know, the intentions are good. Like, oh, I want to stop smoking, or I want to drink less, or eat more healthily, or go to the gym. And yet we find when the habits, when our habits, if they're strong, if they come into conflict, when our intentions come into conflict with a strong habit, what wins out? The habits do. Because they are this, you know, they have this immediacy to them. This, what Kahneman talked about as this system one. You know, I need to do this. And so the habits, when even if we intend to change habits, it can be very hard to do that if the habit is strongly developed, strongly entrenched. Does this mean we can't change our habits? Obviously not. Probably, has anyone here changed an unwanted behavior or know of others who've maybe changed very painful habits in your life? Anybody been able to change? There are different things that in the research shows can be helpful in changing habits, changing our environment, sometimes avoiding things that would trigger the habit arising, you know, as in 12-step programs, people are encouraged not to go, you know, hang out with their old buddies or in their places where they used to do the drinking or the drugs or whatever. Those are really helpful. But what I want to focus on tonight for the remainder of the time is the role of mindfulness in changing habits. So why is mindfulness a key to habit change? I mentioned earlier that mindfulness goes to the heart of habitual behaviors, their automatic repetition outside of conscious awareness once the habit has been established. So the automatic quality of habits means that the behavior is outside of our awareness and not subject to our attention. So what mindfulness does is it brings the behavior and the triggers into awareness. This is good news. So this is the nature of mindfulness, to directly recognize our experience without judgment and without escaping into the habitual behavior. So we bring this, as we did in the meditation, we bring a kind, curious, and non-judging awareness to whatever is arising. So if we feel the trigger of a habit, oh, I want to, feeling that wanting to, or that resisting, or that kind of checking out, when we feel that, we can pause and bring awareness to that and meet that experience with kindness, with acceptance, with interest. So, as I mentioned earlier, I think there are three key elements of mindfulness that are essential in changing harmful or unwanted habits. And these are, as I mentioned, intention, attention, and attitude. And I'll say a few words about each of these, and then I'll focus the remainder of the time on our intentions. Really, our intentions are our guiding star. They connect us with what matters most to us. They also help us identify what's getting in the way of our deepest intentions, or what's kind of an obstacle or a hindrance to being who we really want to be, to being awake or alive or connected or loving or happy. And intention supports our commitment to make necessary changes in our life by just meeting our experience with kindness, with acceptance, with interest. So I'll focus more in a minute on intention. I'll talk a little bit about the other two of these elements of mindfulness. They're really in any definition of mindfulness. If you look at John Kabat-Zinn's definition, I don't have it in my head, but it's about really intentionally bringing awareness to our present moment's experience, non-judgmentally. Tara Brach's definition is very similar. You know, bringing, you know, a non-judging, accepting awareness to our experience. Any real understanding of mindfulness, I think, has these elements, that we're intentional. We're intentional about being aware of our experience. We're paying attention to whatever is arising, you know, just as it is. And we're meeting our experience with attitudes that support being present, with kindness, with interest, with acceptance. Just accepting this moment as it is. So accepting, you know, the arising of a painful experience, a painful habitual energy, or a painful urge, you know, a craving for something. Not to judge that, oh, I'm a bad person or I'm wrong for feeling this, but to just feel it, oh, this is what's here. Can I meet it with kindness? Can I meet it with care? Can I meet it with acceptance? So attention, the second of these elements, allows us to prevent unwholesome, unskillful patterns and habits from arising. What's really important about attention in relation to habits is we can bring attention to habits in three different time periods. We can bring awareness to the habits before they arise. So if, for example, say you have issues around eating and you want to eat healthily, and you find, you know, you very habitually go to the fridge for some ice cream or the cupboard, as I call it, what's it called here, for some cookies or cake or whatever. You can prevent that by one thing you might do is when you go to the store, you say, I'm only going to buy things. I'm not going to buy ice cream. I'm not going to buy cookies. I'm not going to buy cake. I'm only going to buy things that are healthy that will support me in my diet or in my, you know, what do you bring to work? You know, the lunch that you bring to work, etc. So we can, in Buddhism, this has a very interesting kind of clunky, it's a little bit clunky, but it's called preventing the arising of the unarisen, unskillful state. Preventing the arising of the unarisen, unskillful state. So kind of seeing when something unhelpful or habitual or painful emotion or mind state is going to arise and kind of preventing it from coming up. What do I need to do to not go down that pathway? How can I do that in advance? So we can, with attention, we can do that. We can bring awareness to, you know, what triggers, you know, and avoid, you know, go down. If there's a, you know, if we find every time we go past this fast food restaurant, we stop and have a Big Mac or whatever, we say, oh, I'm going to go home a different direction. You know, I'm going to make that choice. So preventing before the habit has even arisen, we can bring attention to our experience as it's arising, when it's being triggered. And this can be particularly helpful when we're working with challenging urges, cravings, feelings that are really hard to deal with. Like, you know, imagine that you're addicted. You know, I'm not saying that mindfulness in relation to addictions will normally need to be supported by other practices, 12-step programs, you know. But mindfulness is really a key. It allows us to ride the waves of the difficult experience, to ride the waves of the urges, of the triggers, of the difficult emotions. And we can do this as a meditation practice, you know, a mindfulness practice in the present moment of just feeling, you know, we're wanting something. How does this wanting feel in the body? How does it feel in the mind? What's the mind saying? Oh, got to have this. Okay, watch that arising. See that all of these experiences are impermanent, they're transitory, they're changing. And if we can open to that experience, and sometimes it can be challenging riding these waves, but we can ride the waves of urges, of triggers, of craving. And with practice, with training, we can let go of these. We can just see that these patterns, these habits, these urges come and go. You know, probably anyone who's given up smoking will have experienced, you know, for a few days or a few weeks, you know, after you've stopped, how you feel those urges in the body. You feel like that kind of, that moving towards, that wanting to have or wanting to light up a cigarette. And you can feel, okay, how is it to feel this? How is it to be with this? It's a great question we can ask when we're, you know, if otherwise we would be going into an unhealthy behavior, something that's habitual, something that's afflictive or difficult, is what would I have to be with if I wasn't going to make that choice? If I wasn't going to go for the cookie or the ice cream or the cigarette or the, you know, just talking about those particular forms of habits, what would I have to experience? And almost always it'll be something painful, something difficult, something challenging. But with practice, we can train ourselves to open to these painful, difficult experiences and see that ultimately they're impersonal. They're impermanent, they're impersonal, they don't last, they can't be held on to, they come and go. So the training is to train the mind to be willing to be with whatever is, to be with what is. And meditations like the riding the waves of our experience can be very helpful in working with these painful and difficult experiences. Some of you are probably familiar with the rain meditation. That's another one. Recognizing what you're experiencing, allowing it, investigating, bringing interest, intimate attention to the experience, really being curious, you know, not in a storyline, but just really, oh, what does this feel like? How is it in my body, in my heart, in my mind? So, and then, you know, meeting it in a not, recognizing, allowing, investigating, and not judging. What did I say? Not judgment, not self. Yeah, that this isn't actually me or mine. You know, it just kind of, it's something that comes and it goes. So we can bring awareness to these experiences before, during, riding the waves. And we can also bring attention to the experience after it's happened. You know, if we've been able to avoid the habitual pattern, we can feel, oh, appreciate that. Take it in, as Rick Hansen says, take in the good. Allow ourselves to really feel that, experience it, appreciate it. And if we have lapsed, if we've acted out the habit, we've done it and, you know, we might otherwise say, oh, I'm terrible, I'm always doing this, I'm never going to be able to change this. You know, we could easily get into judgment or harshness or criticism. We can meet that experience with kindness, with non-judgment. So we can meet our experience with, we can pay attention both before, during, and after the arising of the habit. So intention, attention. And then the third of these qualities is the attitudes that we bring to our experience. And these are really crucial. How we meet our experience really determines the space in which we can hold it. And so the three qualities that I think are really essential to our attitudes are, three essential attitudes are kindness, meeting our experience with kindness, with self-compassion, allowing what's here to be as it is, kind, curious, that's the second quality of interest, being interested in our experience. So we're kind of looking at it not as, oh, something that's wrong or something that's separate from us, but just, oh, this is what's arising right now. And this quality of interest or curiosity or investigation is really helpful for knowing, oh, what might be a good way of responding? You know, what am I learning from this experience? So bringing curiosity or interest to our experience. And the final one, the final quality is acceptance. Is accepting this is what's arising right now. And as Tara Brach has spoken about and written about, making that acceptance a radical acceptance. You know, a deep-rooted acceptance of what's here. Truly saying yes to what is. Saying yes to this moment without resisting it. Just a wholehearted yes to what is. As the Jesuit philosopher and writer Anthony de Mello said, he talked about it as absolute cooperation with the inevitable. Absolute cooperation with the inevitable. The inevitable is really what's here. Not that it had to be here. If conditions were different, it might have been different. But right now, this is what is here. It's unavoidable. So freedom, enlightenment, is to cooperate absolutely with what is here, what is inevitable, what can't really be resisted in this moment. Or if we do resist it, then it becomes a problem. We get into conflict with our experience. And as the Buddha said, we suffer. So what I'd like to do is to finish with a meditation this evening. It'll just be a short meditation. It will be connecting with what matters most. So just a reflection on our intention. And it may be, hopefully, that you might leave with some sense of what your deepest intention is, what matters most to you, and also what maybe gets in the way of your deepest intention, and something it might be worth bringing greater awareness to. So again, just you don't need to get into any particular position, but just sit comfortably. You might begin. Let your attention go inward and come inward, and if it's helpful, close your eyes. Just ask yourself, what is it that matters most to me in my life? What is my deepest longing for myself, maybe for those close to me, perhaps for the world? What do I care about most deeply? What matters most? And just see what comes up. For some, it might be peace, happiness, loving connections with others. Or it might be enlightenment, freedom of the heart. It might be a wish for a more peaceful world, a more loving world. If you can, and don't worry if nothing is coming up for you, and just you can just bring awareness to your breathing, just whatever's present for you. But if you can, when you've reflected, perhaps come up with an intention or intentions for yourself, just what matters most to you, what you care about most deeply, you might visualize yourself experiencing and really living this intention. Let yourself experience any emotions, sensations, feelings, living this intention, how it feels in your body, in your heart, in your mind. If you can, feel this intention, this your deepest intention in an embodied way. Maybe something in the heart area or the torso or the face. Breathe in the intention, and if perhaps a word comes to you, it might be peace or happiness or love, presence. Allow yourself to feel this. Allow yourself to really experience this, your deepest wish, your deepest aspiration for yourself, perhaps for those close to you, for the world. You might, if something helpful, important has come up, you might write it down later. Come back and revisit it on a regular basis. Just remembering what really matters. And when or if you found an expression of what matters most to you, your deepest wish, you might just reflect, can you discern any patterns of thought or action, any way that you might be living that block or hinder your realization of your deepest intention? This is a question really of what gets in the way. Is there anything that gets in the way? Anything you feel that you're doing or way that you think about yourself that feels like it's an obstacle. When I'm feeling that, I feel disconnected from my deepest intention of who I am. You know, it might be habit of wanting, or it might be distraction, might be resisting something, getting caught up in resistance or avoiding, or it might be kind of constantly on the way somewhere, habits of doing. You might just ask yourself, is there an activity that I feel somehow I'm hiding from myself or from others, or that you don't want to look at closely, that maybe keeps you disconnected from yourself or your loved ones? Is there a pattern of thinking, maybe self-judgment or thoughts of unworthiness, that prevent you believing that any meaningful change is possible? Just opening to whatever might be blocking or hindering your connection with your deepest wish for yourself and for your life. You might notice any bodily sensations and emotions or thoughts that are present when you bring awareness to this habit or this pattern. And if you have come up with some pattern, some behavior, some habit that feels like gets in the way or hinders you living a full life, you might ask yourself how important it is to make a change in this habit or this pattern. And what's really important is, as you bring awareness to these patterns that may be difficult or painful or uncomfortable, that you meet your experience with an attitude of kindness. You might, it's helpful, you can always put your hand on your heart or on your belly, just connecting with the life that's here, caring for this life, for yourself, bringing interest to your experience, meeting it with deep acceptance. Just to finish moving towards finishing this evening with just three questions and reflections. What is it that matters most in your life? What is your deepest intention? And if you can connect with this deep aspiration or wish for yourself or the world, you might commit to aligning your actions and your life with that intention, so that what you do really inclines your mind, your heart, to that deep intention for yourself and for your life. And the second is to identify the habits or patterns that hinder what matters most, and perhaps to commit to the intention to make a change, to bringing mindfulness to changing and old habit or cultivating a new and more helpful one. So what gets in the way in identifying what hinders your deepest intentions? And as you bring awareness to your moment-to-moment experience, you might establish and return to the intention to move towards what matters most, and choose to stay with your experience, your present moment experience, rather than defaulting to habitual thoughts and habitual behaviors. So if you like to, if you have your eyes closed or kind of more inward looking, just to come back to the final couple of minutes of the talk, just to come back again to the main points that when harmful or unhealthy habits form, they can cause us a lot of suffering, and they can be hard to change for the reasons that I spoke about this evening. But that mindfulness is a key to changing habits, because it brings awareness basically to unawareness. And I've talked about just some of the simple things we can do to bring awareness to these patterns, both before, during, and after. Bringing as well these qualities, these attitudes of heart and mind that allow us the space to hold, particularly the difficult experiences that arise. And I talked about these three elements of intention, attention, and attitude. And there must be a poem to finish with. So this little snippet for a little part of a poem from Dorothy Hunt, her poem Peace. She says, does peace require an absence from your boss, your spouse, yourself? Do you think peace will come some other place than here, some other time than now, in some other heart than yours? Peace is this moment without judgment, this moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. Peace is this moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. Thank you very much for your kind attention this evening. If you're interested in more of this, I'll be offering some courses in the new year on mindfulness and habits, and I've offered those before. And welcome to come to any of the classes on Sunday mornings, and obviously all of the other classes of IMCW. So thank you again. Namaste.